This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we honor the 100th anniversary of the Irish Easter Uprising and talk about one of its leaders, James Connolly. Paul Buell, who edited the comic pamphlet, A Full Life, James Connolly, the Irish Rebel, joins us to talk about Connolly and the Easter Rising. We're also joined by musician Matt Callahan and his comrade and companion Yvonne Moore, who put together the CD Songs of Freedom. And the show will include a special treat, Yvonne Moore singing a cappella from a song on the CD.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Executed by a British firing squad on May 12, 1916, for his role in organizing the Easter Rising, James Connolly was one of the most prominent radical organizers and agitators of his day. Born in Scotland in 1868 to Irish immigrant parents, Connolly spent most of his adult life organizing for labor unions and socialist organizations in Ireland, Scotland, and the United States. Despite attending school for only a few years, Connolly became a leading socialist writer and theoretician, founding and editing newspapers including The Socialist in Scotland, The Harp in the United States, and The Workers' Republic in Ireland. As a labor organizer, Connolly stressed the importance of direct action, broad working class unity, and a commitment to ending labor's exploitation. As a socialist agitator, Connolly saw economic and political independence as inextricably intertwined. The pamphlet, A Full Life, James Connolly, the Irish Rebel, is the first graphic treatment of Connolly's life. It's been issued on the centenary of the Easter Rising. Editor Paul Buell, formerly a senior lecturer at Brown University and producer of Radical Comics, joins us today to talk about James Connolly, his history in the IWW, and his role in the Irish Uprising of 1916. Paul Buell, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Paul, you know, I have to say, this illustrated graphic remembrance of James Connolly and his life and the Easter Rising is just beautiful. That you and your colleague Tom Kyo put it out on the 100th anniversary of the Easter Rising is just perfect timing. It's such a welcome addition to the literature and so unique because you did it in a comic form. So congratulations on that. But let's talk about James Connolly. James Connolly, people, even if they know something about James Connolly, probably don't realize that he spent a lot of years here in the United States and he was in the IWW. And I wanted to ask you about that.
Yes, I'm happy to speak about it a bit. Well, James Connolly, who really came to the U.S. in 1900 as a terribly impoverished head of a family, he had a glorious past. In the 1890s, he had become a leader of the Socialist League in Scotland and came to Dublin and in 1898 led a then considered to be notorious demonstration against the appearance of Queen Victoria and some kind of golden jubilee. And he was the center of socialist and labor agitation in all of Ireland in those days when it was one colony. But he could not live on the money provided by the labor and socialist movement, so he moved to the U.S. without his family. He came to Troy, New York, and shortly thereafter, after his family joined him, he really organized relief and in some ways as an orator helped to lead the strike of collar makers. It was the center of those celluloid collars that used to go in all clothes. He moved from there to New Jersey, where he became a strike organizer. But the most important thing that happened to him was the founding of the Industrial Workers of the World in 1905. Now, people are newly interested in the IWW, more than 100 years old now, because Bernie Sanders has hailed a strike or an organizing drive by hamburger workers in Oregon. The first time that anybody can remember that a major party candidate in the United States has supported the IWW. It may not be the biggest labor news in the world, but it's dramatic and contributes to our warm feelings towards Bernie Sanders. At any rate, the IWW is an utterly unique creation because it insisted on its founding by a wide spectrum in the labor movement that there would be a sort of industrial, social, cooperative society that would replace the entire political class. They didn't believe there would be a great vanguard party or any kind of party that would lead the future government. Instead, the government would be strictly functional, non-political. And this idea spread rapidly among the new industrial workers in the U.S., many of them immigrants, but also among the most miserable of workers, those who worked on crops out in the West or in mines and so forth, because many of these people were outside the scope of the American Federation of Labor, which had been largely limited to white craft workers who had other relatives in these enterprises, so that it was exclusionary of women, exclusionary of non-whites, and politically quite conservative. So the IWW offered a different vision, one big union, as they called it, the greatest thing on earth. And it spread not too rapidly, but began to reach these unskilled, supposedly unskillable workers who could unite despite their ethnic differences and racial differences and fight the employers. And James Connolly was a tremendous benefit to this organization because he could speak directly to Irish American workers who, being so heavily influenced by the church, Catholic Church, but also heavily influenced among the skilled sector of Irish by the American Federation of Labor. The local Irish building trades, for instance, had heavy influence within some city governments. They got good work for themselves by making the work of other workers more miserable. And they were always difficult to organize by the Socialist Party. So Jim Connolly represented a way to get through to these people, and he even created an Irish-American newspaper, The Harp, that came out monthly and spoke in terms of the oppression that the Irish had suffered and how they should join with other working people in America to build one big union, but also to build prospects for a successful revolutionary transformation in Ireland itself. And he had a great charisma. He was sort of hired by the Socialist Party around 1908, 1909, to go on this massive speaking tour. And he had the full support of a magazine that had a tremendous circulation, the International Socialist Review, published by the Charles H. Kerr Company in Chicago in those days, the first magazine to ever invite its readers to send in photos, then quite an accomplishment. That going on tour for the Kerr Company and the International Socialist Review and the IWW and Socialist Party under the auspices of the HARP, he brought together a very, very wide spectrum of working people. And while he was there, while he was touring from place to place, night to night, exciting enormous crowds, he was able to pen several utterly extraordinary books that had a wide circulation. The widest circulation was a combination of labor poems by himself and by others who had similar sentiments. They're extremely sentimental, but they delivered the sentiment of the Irish sense of oppression, also the love of family, the hatred of what had been done by the bosses and by the English control and so forth, published by a little Irish-American firm in New York City. It was called Labor Poems by James Connolly and others. sold for a nickel. And like other poetry written in Yiddish, for instance, not very far away in the Lower East Side of New York, it was picked up by choruses to sing. And some places, these songs that he and others wrote were published in this little booklet are still sung today by Irish choruses. So it's easy to see what an emotional impact. Well, if that weren't enough, he also wrote a book published in 1910 called Labor in Ireland. This was an extraordinary book, remembering that he was entirely self-educated. He'd grown up in the slums of Edinburgh, Scotland, at an Irish enclave. He joined the army as a teenager to get away from misery and poverty, and he deserted from the English army 7 years later and managed not to be caught. He wrote this book about labor through the ages in Ireland, and what he demonstrated was that the Irish had suffered from centuries of English oppression, not only economically and politically, but culturally as well, that there had been a compulsory underdevelopment of the Irish economy at large. And now, it's important to note that he was making an argument about empire not only in Ireland, but also the role of empire throughout the world. At the same time, he was writing this very remarkable book anticipating Lenin, Luxembourg, and others. He was writing ferocious polemics against the role of the English Empire in India. This was something that socialists around the world had not really taken up as an issue. More conservative socialists, like Edward Bernstein in Germany, believed that the colonies were good because they were going to uplift those poor, benighted, non-white people across the world. Those countries would become industrial. They'd have a proletariat. Someday they'd join the world socialist proletariat, and so forth and so forth. Without any formal education, James Connolly saw that the opposite was much closer to the truth.
Paul, I wanted to thank you for because in the book pamphlet, A Full Life, James Connolly, the Irish Rebel, which you edited and wrote the afterword, you also included a short essay by James Connolly on the situation in India, and it really is a marvelous essay on the impact of colonialism. I thought it was really valuable to have in the pamphlet, that essay. But let me ask you this. Let's switch our focus now from his accomplishments in the United States, where the IWW was battling free speech fights. They took on the tactic of direct action to win good results for workers. And then he goes back to Ireland, and he plays a role in Ireland up until 1916 and the Irish Rebellion, the Great Rebellion on Easter Sunday, exactly 100 years ago. And I wanted you to talk about Connolly in Ireland, and let's talk about the Easter Uprising and its tradition, its accomplishments.
Sure. The first thing to say is that in the several years leading up to the outbreak of war in Europe, there was really an uprising of unskilled workers across much of the European continent, England and Ireland included. The skilled workers, the socialist parties based on skilled workers, and other ordinary observers couldn't believe their eyes. It was as if the European workers had followed the IWW strikers in the U.S., in the Lawrence and Patterson strikes, that is, of 1912 and 1914, in rising up against the fact that the organized labor had not invited them in, that they were considered hopelessly unorganizable, and so on and so forth. So that when Connolly went back saying, anyone can do what I did in the U.S., but I must do something in Ireland no one else can do, he really went back to lead the labor movement. And there were tremendous strikes, a sort of virtual general strike in Dublin, horrible repression, and all manner of efforts to move ahead with labor and, on the other hand, to crush it completely. So we're up to around 1914, 1915, and the war is underway. Now, Connolly had always said, even if a single English soldier or English colonialist were not present in Ireland, but capitalism remained, Ireland would not be free. He truly believed that. And yet, the weight of oppression of Ireland was so great and had gone on for so many centuries that when war presented an absolute social crisis for the British Empire, for England as a society, that seemed to be the one moment not to be missed within a lifetime to rise up and revolt in armed force.
Well, what were the prospects?
That's an interesting question. There's a new fascinating book just appearing now from Monthly Review Press, from Verso Publishers, on the history of the barricades, and another on the Paris Commune. And these are valuable for us to think about because Connolly, like other socialists of the time, revolutionary socialists at that time, studied the Paris Commune and the rising in barricades very, very, very closely. There were all kinds of tactical things about entrances from one house so that guerrilla fighters could move from place to place and work against a far larger support of soldiers. He and his friends had thought this through very carefully. And when the call came to organize a rebellion within Dublin, there was an expectation that a German ship would land somewhere off Ireland and deliver thousands of guns. Well, various things happened, and the German ship was scuttled by the sailors on it forcibly as the English were approaching. So they didn't get those guns. There were several other miscues or misunderstandings. As Connolly said, before he died, that he thought that the British troops would never shell the areas in Dublin inhabited by ordinary citizens, and that he'd been terribly wrong. The brutality of the English exceeded his expectations. The second thing is that he and his comrades had expected that poor people in Dublin would rise up with them, this relatively small organized force, and that there would be uprisings in the countryside. Neither of those happened. It's true there was unrest in Dublin, but mostly people were looting, from the poor taking whatever they could get until the unrest ended. And secondly, the uprising in the countryside, severely under the control of the Catholic Church at the time, just simply did not take place. Now, what's interesting about this, beyond the disappointment and the martyrdom of Jim Connolly and his comrades, is that the English drew the conclusion, or overdrew the conclusion, that all uprising, all unrest had to be put down with a great deal of force. The amount of English soldiers beating, killing out of hand, and destroying houses and so forth was quite terrible. And then as the years went on, a kind of low-level civil war continued. The returned soldiers that the English used to name black and tan for their outfits, which some people say were soldiers chosen because they had PTSD, were renowned, or rather despised by people around the world for the level of rape, murder, and ransacking ordinary people's homes. And it was so severe and monstrous that it really brought the Irish public against further occupation by the English. And so finally, English allowed all but six counties to enter a different status within the Commonwealth and became the Irish Free State, a very politically conservative Irish Free State, very much dominated in a very bad way by the Catholic Church, but nevertheless a free state standing outside of the old English Empire, per se.
What was the role of women? What role did they play in the uprising?
There are two different ways to answer that. One is that several of the absolutely leading forces within this, Constance Markovich being really the outstanding one, were organizing on their own, and so were charismatic personalities followed by Irish people of all kinds, that they'd been revered as remarkable women and remarkable Irish people. The second thing is that women's brigades, similar to the women's brigades in the CIO 20 years later, were organizing logistically and in some cases taking up weapons. There's an important book, which I don't have the citation of here, written several years ago about the role of women in the Irish Rebellion. So the scholarship is catching up with the reality of history.
So do you think that the rebellion in Ireland inspired other colonial peoples?
Well, it's remarkable and strange to realize that even Jewish revolutionaries seeking a Jewish state considered themselves inspired by the Irish.
Let's put
it a different way. Connolly thought, as did a handful of socialist leaders during World War I, that the only way the war could end and the way the war would end would be by revolutionary forces taking their countries out of the war, declaring war against war. This happened in Russia, of course. That's the decisive case. It happened also in Hungary temporarily.
Well, the Russian Revolution was the greatest anti-war movement of them all.
Well, exactly so. And Connolly, among others, believed that that was a possibility and that it was at least conceivable that the Irish Revolution would set off such revolutions in other places. It was only 1 year before the October Revolution in Russia, so he wasn't entirely wrong.
Well, Paul, we're coming to the end of our allotted time, but I wanted to ask you how your illustrated pamphlet makes sense within the growth and the development of radical historical nonfiction comic art.
Well, I want to mention to WAI listeners that 8 years ago, my adaptation of Howard Zinn's classic, the adaptation called A People's History of American Empire, was used as a fundraiser, I'm very proud to say. and that Michael and I have worked on similar subjects, an earlier comic production, Che, a graphic biography by Spain Rodriguez, a subject we share in common. The previous book of most previous comic of mine, Red Rosa, a graphic biography of Rosa Luxemburg by Kate Evans, is very much around. And the very next one to come down the pike is co-edited by Michael and myself. It's called Len. It's about the great heroic life of civil libertarian radical lawyer Leonard Weinglass, and as drawn by artist Seth Tabachman.
Well, why do you think a recognition of James Connolly now is on the agenda for us here in 2016?
Well, it's very interesting to me that one doesn't hear the name James Connolly too much over here, really only among Irish societies by and large. But any visit to Ireland, to Galway and Cork, and above all Dublin, we'll find statues, memorials, words carved in stone. It's as if James Connolly never died. It's been more vividly so the last month or so because of the literal anniversary. But among Irish people there, James Connolly remains this sort of giant in the same way that Che Guevara remains in the hearts of people all across Latin America, not to mention other places. And in the same way that Rosa Luxemburg has her name uplifted in parts of Germany and elsewhere, it has something to do with martyrs. Every society for the last 500 years at least has loved its martyrs, people that sacrificed their lives going back to Joan of Arc and long before that. But these particular socialist and revolutionary martyrs, the sacrifice they made to bring about a better society is something we bear in our minds and in our hearts.
Well, thank you so much, Paul Buell, the editor of A Full Life, James Connolly, the Irish Rebel. Paul edited, and Tom Coe did the graphic work and the story. It's a wonderful pamphlet. You can get it from PM Press. Thanks so much, Paul Buell, for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Songs of Freedom is the name of the songbook initially edited by James Connolly and re-edited by Matt Callahan and republished by PM Press. Connolly's introduction is better known than the collection for which it was written, containing his oft-quoted maxim, "Until the movement is marked by the joyous, defiant singing of revolutionary songs, it lacks one of the most distinctive marks of a popular revolutionary movement. It is the dogma of a few and not the faith of the multitude." Songs of Freedom is a celebration of the life and work of James Connolly, the Irish revolutionary socialist martyred by the British government for his role in the Easter Rising of 1916. Songs of Freedom, the CD, makes contemporary music out of old revolutionary songs. The band turns the timeless lyrics of James Connolly into timely manifestos for today. Giving expression to Connolly's internationalism, musical influences ranging from traditional Irish airs to American rhythm and blues are combined. Matt Callahan, the editor of the book and the leader of the band, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. I'm glad to be here.
Matt, tell us a little bit about your political and musical background before we get into the James Connolly songs and book. But I want to ask you how you came to do this project. So musically, you had a band out in San Francisco, the Looters, in the 80s. Talk about your musical background, please.
Yeah, well, I am a product of the 60s in San Francisco, and that includes, you know, everything from Santana to the Black Panthers. It's the mixture of music and politics that was very much a part of my background. And I was in a band called the Looters that in the 80s was playing what was called World Beat, hence the international or internationalist expression in my own personal music. That didn't specifically lead to Connolly, but when I turned 60 in 2011, I wanted to celebrate my birthday, which happens to be on July 14th, Bastille Day, by singing revolutionary songs. And at that time, I'd moved from San Francisco to Bern, Switzerland. It just so happened that a number of my personal musical friends were Irish, and we decided, particularly given the dire straits the Irish economy was in at that particular moment, that it would be quite appropriate to sing Irish revolutionary songs.
You share a birthday with Woody Guthrie, I think.
Indeed, yeah.
So how did you conceive of this project of redoing James Connolly's songs? I mean, I didn't even know that James Connolly wrote songs.
Right. Well, actually, I didn't either. It was putting together a repertoire for my birthday party that led us to explore the repertoire. I mean, you know, there are thousands of Irish revolutionary songs. I mean, really, it's a long tradition, and there are many, many to choose from. But it just so happened that two of the guys, Joe McHugh and Alan Burke, who were involved with this project from the very beginning, are good, staunch Connolly men. And since I was too, not for any particular historical reasons, but just being raised with legend and lore of James Connolly, my brother was named after him, and so on and so forth, that, you know, it was sort of natural. And we thought at the time that it would be very easy to find this Songs of Freedom, which is, I'd known about. I'd heard the mention of this songbook, not knowing, never having seen it, you know, but thinking in the internet day and age, you know, you just sort of go on somewhere and find Songs of Freedom, you know. And it turns out we couldn't find Songs of Freedom. And I started contacting Irish booksellers and found a guy in Cong County, Mayo, who said, "You're not going to find one because there is only one copy in existence." And I said, "Yeah, but we've only got a couple of months and I got to put together these songs and I'd like to use Connolly's lyrics." And he said, "Well, you can get a copy of the James Connolly songbook." And he found me one in London. And it turned out that songbook had been published in 1972 by the Cork Workers Club. And it was just a little chapbook, you know, with a couple staples on it. Very, very simple and low budget. And in fact, all it really had were texts of songs. It didn't have any instructions about music or anything like that. It was just the lyrics. And that's what we started to work with, and that's how the project evolved. Originally, only to celebrate my birthday, but after we'd done it with a whole bunch of musicians, and it was you know, you might call a great deal of fun and something of a musical success, then the Irish guys said, "Look, we've got to put this out. People have not heard Connolly's own lyrics sung." And so that's how the project evolved into something, you know, really serious. And I went to find the original Songs of Freedom in the Dublin National Library, and upon reading it, realized this has to be republished. And that's how the whole thing came about.
Matt, you've got a song, Human Freedom, on the CD. Introduce it for us. Let's play it for the audience.
Okay. In this song, you have two interesting elements. One is that it is one of the few songs that we found that did have a traditional Irish air put to it. That it, there was instructions to the tune of Clare, to the air of Clare's Dragoons, which is a traditional Irish song. So we actually used the original melody. We stayed true to that. But as people will hear, the texts that Connolly wrote are quite of a high literary quality and quite a mouthful to sing, let alone to get the audience to join in on, which was clearly his intent. So we had to devise a musical rhythm and style, if you want to call it, that could encourage participation.
Well, let's play it.
Okay.
History's page, the best.
That was Human Freedom from the James Connolly Songs and Freedom Band, organized by Matt Callahan, our guest. Matt, you've been touring really not just Europe, but the United States with these songs, and you're here for the Left Forum.
That's correct.
Talk to us about what's been the reaction of people to learning about James Connolly and listening to this music.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question for perhaps not obvious reasons. I mean, to begin with, when we first started performing it in the United States, we were really not sure whether or not people completely ignorant of Connolly, perhaps even unaware of the Easter Rising or any of these famous events, that historical events, whether they would respond at all, you know. And again, when you hear these texts, they're not, it's certainly understandable English, but it's not contemporary poetry. It's not the way we write songs today. And so we were actually quite impressed with the fact that almost from the beginning, young people in particular responded, and I think it was because of the spirit in the songs themselves, their overtly revolutionary character, and not just give peace a chance kind of thing. You know, this was like really strong stuff, and I think that it was so spirited, both in terms of Connolly's original intent, and I think the musical delivery that we try to give it, that it really touches people. And we found that to be universally true. In other words, not just in the United States, but we've played this music in Switzerland, in Italy, and of course Scotland, England, and Ireland, where you would expect it to be responded to. You know, people do respond to it there, of course. In fact, we played Human Freedom, the last song you heard, on the stage in front of the General Post Office in Dublin on April 24th this year, the actual 100th anniversary. And it was a wonderful sight to see, you know, thousands and thousands of Irish people with their fists in the air singing "Shout Hurrah!" So
that's fantastic, you know, because it was the General Post Office that the Rising captured,
right,
on that date. That's wonderful.
Yeah, it was a high point for us. It was a reward for all of our effort. Yvonne Moore is my partner and a very important component of this project for both musical and other organizational reasons. She's done a lot to make this happen, including lending her voice. And I guess we're going to ask you to sing "Where Oh Where Is James Connolly?"
Okay.
This is a song by Patrick Galvin. It's called "Where Oh Where Is Our James Connolly?"
Where, oh, where is our James Connolly? Where, oh, where is that gallant man? He's gone to organize the Union, that working men might yet be free. Then who will lead the van? Then who will lead the van? Oh, who but our James Connolly, the hero of the working man? Then who will carry high the burning flag? Who will carry high that burning flag? Oh, who but our James Connolly can carry high that burning flag? They carried him up to the jail. They carried him up to the jail, and then they shut him down one bright May morning and quickly laid him in his grave. Who will mourn the death of this brave man? Who will mourn the death of this brave man? Oh, bury me down in yon green garden with Union men on every side. So we buried him down in yon green garden with Union men on every side. And we swore we would build a mighty weapon to fill James Connolly's name with pride. Where, oh, where is our James Connolly? Where, oh, where is that gallant man? He's gone to organize the union that working men might yet be free.
Well, thank you very much, Yvonne Moore. Yvonne is one of the singers on the James Connolly Songs of Freedom Band. The CD is put out by PM, as is the book, Songs of Freedom. PM put that out also. We're grateful to them and grateful to have Matt Callahan and his companion and comrade Yvonne Moore on Law and Disorder. I wanted to ask you, what is the relevance of James Connolly for today?
Well, of course, there are many different dimensions to that, insofar as he spoke and worked in a wide range of areas, from actual cultural work, you might say. His advocacy of revolutionary songs is actually quite famous. He was also extremely important as a labor leader, of organizing the working class as an international effort, and not in the narrow confines of Ireland or any other one country. But he was also extremely important historically, insofar as his recognition that the struggle of oppressed people against, you know, imperialism, in this case British imperialism, but of course that extends to any form of imperialist oppression, means that a broad united front of forces opposed to that system need to be brought together. And he was pretty much a pioneer of that, something that after World War II certainly swept the world. We're talking about, you know, the national liberation struggles, you know, Chinese, India, Vietnam, Cuba, and so on, and throughout Africa and Latin America. A lot of that is an expression and a vindication of the position Connolly took in Ireland. And so I think that his relevance is, on one hand, historical, in the sense that he's a reference point for people interested in revolutionary struggle. But a lot of his ideas, to conclude, are very much relevant today. So, for example, as we reprinted it in the songbook, the program of the Irish Socialist Republican Party that he founded in 1896 is as applicable today as it would be over 100 years ago. Of course, it would need to be developed and built upon, but if you just start with the abolition of private banks, for example, and things of that nature, you're talking about programs that would have saved the Irish people, not to mention everybody else, a whole lot of trouble.
And talking about working people and their allies forming their own political party,
right,
and not the party of either Hillary Clinton or Donald
exactly.
Trump.
Absolutely.
Well, Matt Callahan, it's been great having you on the show. And Yvonne Moore, thank you for coming in unrehearsed and singing that beautiful song. And really good luck with Songs of Freedom, both the CD and the book. PM put it out. Thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Where, oh, where is our James Connolly? Where, oh,
if you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
The union that working man might yet be free. Then who will lead the van? Then who will lead the van? Who bought our James Connolly? The hero of the working man. Who will carry high the burning flag? Who will carry high the burning flag? Who bore our James Connolly? Could carry high the burning flag. They carried him up to the jail. They carried him up to the jail. Then they shot him down on a bright May morning and quickly laid him in his grave. Who mourns the death of this brave man? Who mourns the death of this brave man? Oh, bury me down in yon green garden with Union men on every side. So we buried him down in yon green garden with Union men on every side. And we swore we would form a mighty weapon that James Connolly's name would be filled with pride. Where, oh, where is our James Connolly? Where, oh, where is that gallant man? He's gone to organize the Union that working men might yet be free. Thank you.